Hello and welcome to the 90 Minutes or Less Film Fest. My name is Sam Clements and this is the podcast that celebrates films with a 90 minute or less runtime. In each episode, a guest will select a film and join me to add to our ongoing fictional film festival. Today, we're joined by film and culture writer Lillian Crawford. Hello, Lillian. Thank you for joining us today.
It's such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
It's a delight to have you on the show. You're someone whose work I've read or listened to or seen in a variety of different forms over the years. I think you've got a very impressive number of credits to your name. How did you get into this line of work? I understand there's no sort of clear line necessarily into sort of film criticism and journalism.
I started writing film reviews when I started at university, and I just got kind of obsessed with it. I don't know, I hadn't really done much before that point, and I then did an internship at Little White Lies, and that really helped with sort of getting started. And then I've just knocked on everyone's door since then. I mean, the reason why there's such a diverse range of credits is because I would just ask anyone if they will let me write for them or work for them. And yeah, it just sort of has built from there.
Regardless of the subject, what's the thing that you personally enjoy about the process?
I think I just loved going to the cinema all the time to distract myself from the madness of university work and life, and found that I had lots of thoughts about films that seemed quite different to how most people were perceiving films. I generally like films that most people don't like, or vice versa. So I think that was part of the appeal of that.
Did you ever think that this pastime of yours could become your profession?
Well, no, I was doing history and thought I was going to be an historian. So very strange that I sort of found out that you can actually do this and do it for a job. It's sort of by accident that I've actually ended up doing this, but I do enjoy it. And because I watch films constantly, it's quite nice to be able to actually sort of turn that into something useful.
I guess if the film in question ever tackles a historical subject, you're like, is this my time to shine?
Yeah, absolutely.
I've read essays by you. I've heard you on podcasts. I've read movie reviews. Is there sort of a particular, sort of avenue of culture writing and journalism that you enjoy more than others?
I do particularly enjoy sort of the longer form sort of criticism rather than just sort of reviewing films straight up, particularly British cinema, and sort of analysing aspects of British cinema, particularly in relation to representation of women. So I have a podcast called Listen to Lillian, where I bring on a guest and we talk about a British film for an hour. And then the other work that I'm particularly proud of and developing on is in relation to autism and cinema. I'm a co-host on a podcast called the Autism Through Cinema podcast, where we take a film and as autistic people and people who some people on the podcast also study autism in relation to cinema for various reasons. That then allows us to sort of reflect on our own autistic selves and our autistic experiences and sensibilities that cinema can bring out in relation to that. And then also working with places like the BFI to run their relaxed screening programs for neurodivergent people. So that's the work that I'm sort of particularly engaged in, I suppose.
Podcasts and work that focuses on exhibition and how people watch films. You mentioned the relaxed screenings for neurodivergent people at the BFI. That is an area of a film which is so important to so many people, but is really not covered very much at all. And that conversation around, I know a few cinemas do, relaxed screenings, autism-friendly screenings and things, but you never really hear people talking about them or sort of writing about them in the media.
Well, that's what I'm trying to work on, is trying to get these things more publicly known. And I think that the conversation around neurodiversity is really improving. And when I'm sort of working with the BFI, putting together screenings, I have, it's about sort of telling them that it's not just about the space that we create, which is very important to have sort of higher levels of lighting, reduced sound levels, space for people to move around, a quiet space for people if they need to leave, so that people can really just sort of unmask without fear that someone's going to shout at them, which or even be physically violent, which does happen and has happened in various settings, even at the BFI. But I think the reason why I think more about sort of films themselves and how films might resonate with neurodivergent people is really important. And funnily enough, one of the main things that I sort of talk about is the runtime of the films. And I always insist that the films that are used in relaxed screenings are kept to 90 minutes or less. So this is one of the reasons why I sort of enjoy listening to the podcast so much and have such an engagement with it, is because I think that it's really important, not just for the speed of which we watch films, but also the fact that there are a lot of people who would not go to the cinema if a film was longer than 90 minutes, because they wouldn't feel comfortable and safe doing so.
That's absolutely up our street, but that's also a really valid and valuable point, which hasn't come up on the show before. We talk about runtimes often, you know, from the craft perspective and not often from the audience perspective. But knowing how long a film is, you know, can really help put people at ease and relax more during that setting. So that's yes, this is, I'm glad it's taken 100 episodes, and I'm glad it's finally come up on the show.
No, if you talk to a lot of sort of neurodivergent people, they will say that they won't go and see a film if it's more than an hour and a half or too much longer than that, for those reasons, that it is partly an engagement thing, particularly for people who have sort of attention deficit conditions, but also just being within the cinema space itself for extended periods of time can be really overwhelming and distressing, and people need to move around. So I think that when we talk about long films and running long films, it's really important to remember that actually things like intermissions at the theatre have a real value to people who are disabled and need to sort of have those breaks and time without feeling like they're missing out on anything. I think that's a really important part of it as well, is that inclusive aspect, so that people don't feel like, because of the condition they have, that they need to miss out on what would happen in a regular program.
Without any sort of direction of, you know, when is a good time to have a break, it's really hard. It puts a lot of pressure on the individual. Like, if I choose to leave now, or if I have to leave now, I don't know what I'm going to miss. But I do love an intermission. For so many reasons.
No one should be holding themselves to the toilet for 3.5 hours. That's not healthy. So, you know, it's not just about a minority of people who wouldn't feel able to do that. It's actually the majority of people, I think, find sitting for that period of time really difficult, and it's unhealthy to sit for that period of time.
I've got a little alert on my watch which tells me to stretch my legs every like 20 minutes, right, or so, and exactly. I'll go crazy during Babylon.
Oh my goodness, yeah.
Does a film's runtime ever impact your decision making process, whether it be at the cinema or watching films at home?
I think if I go to the cinema in the evening, not so much. If I've sort of written off the evening to go and see a film, I won't really be paying much attention to the runtime. But if I'm watching a film at home, always, it depends on how much time I have and what I'm doing. If I'm working and I want to film one in the background, which I'm terrible for, I will quite happily put on something that's 8 hours long, just because that's when I'm gonna watch it, because I do find it hard to just sort of sit and watch, like, I don't know what would come into that category, like one of Jacques Rivette's like longer films or something. I've quite happily just sort of have that on, or a piece of slow cinema, and sort of keep it in the background, making a note to self to watch it again when I actually have that period of time to sort of set aside to watch it and focus on it. So yeah, it does come into it, and it does when, particularly when watching films with other people. I think that the runtime of the film is often the thing that's talked about, because people have bedtimes and that's important.
How did you tackle the homework that we assigned you, to come on the podcast, the challenge of selecting an under 90 minute film? Was there multiple films that came to mind, or were you very, you know, set on one particular title?
No, there were many. I think I sent you a whole list of films that I was quite happy to talk about. I suppose I immediately decided that I wanted to do a film which might be quite obscure to most people, because I think it's a good opportunity to choose a film which people might not have heard of or have seen, but also trying to find what balance that with finding accessible means of actually watching the film, which I think some of the films that I sent to you are just not really available at all, and I can't remember how I first sort of saw them. So I'm glad that we discussed it and we landed on this one, because even though it is still hard to get hold of, it is out there.
You sent over an amazing list of films, but yeah, sadly the reality of what is available for listeners to watch along with is always comes into play there. And I think the one that we're talking about today is sort of just about available enough if you look hard enough for it. If nothing else, the podcast now has a copy on DVD, and we could start like a DVD swap, like a lending library with our listeners, and if we could just pass it on to everybody, that would be great to do. So Lillian, what are we talking about today?
Well, we are talking about Water Lilies by Céline Sciamma.
Céline Sciamma's acclaimed debut film, Water Lilies, is a beautifully observed, intelligent and provocative portrait of female adolescence. Set in the competitive world of synchronized swimming, three 15-year-old girls experience first love, friendship and rivalry in very different ways. Since its premiere at the Cannes Film Festival 2007, the film has been delighting critics and audiences alike. So it's a wonderful pick. And what I love actually about you picking Water Lilies is it is a film by a previous guest on the show. Céline Sciamma joined us a couple of years ago when Petit Maman was released, which is also under 90 minutes. And we had a really nice chat about film runtimes. It was maybe a slightly bizarre conversation for her to have on the press tour for her film, but she was very game. And we had a nice half an hour chat about how long films are and should be. We haven't covered one of her films, and I think quite a few probably are eligible. I'm thinking of, Petit Maman, but also Tomboy is under 90, and then Water Lily's here today. And I think even her longer films aren't that much longer.
I'm trying to think how long Girlhood is, and Portrait's definitely longer. Portrait's just about around the 2-hour mark. But
I'm glad that we finally get to talk about a Céline Sciamma film. I was wondering, when did you first watch Water Lilies? What's your relationship with this film?
Well, we had an amazing film library when I was at university. I did my undergraduate in history, and then I did a master's in film studies, and there was an amazing library, and it had so many hard to find films, including all of Céline Sciamma's films up to that point, including Water Lilies. So I was able to watch it. So I just had an evening where I put it into my projector in my room and watched it and cried my eyes out for 90 minutes. It is such a gorgeous film, and I think I saw it after Portrait of a Lady on Fire came out, because I'd seen that in San Sebastian in 2019, which is my first international film festival, and I fainted at the end of the film, which always sort of makes people think that I'm like some 19th century sort of socialite with a fan, which I guess is kind of how I like to position myself anyway. But the truth is I had run for about 40 minutes along the Basque coast to make it to a screening that I thought was on the other side of San Sebastian, and then just was so emotionally overwhelmed that I think that my body just sort of gave out. But it was, yeah, my relationship with Céline's films is an intense one. I don't think I've seen one of her films and sort of not had a very heightened emotional response to her filmmaking. And Water Lilies is probably only second in my mind to Portrait, which really is my favorite. It's a special relationship. It's quite a powerful film for me.
Oh, wow, what a response to a film as well. Like, that's the sort of feedback, you know, I think filmmakers like hearing it when people have a visceral
I told Céline this, and she was moved, and we had a wonderful conversation. This was around the press tour for Petit Maman, and I told her, you know, your film made me faint and have a sort of existential crisis, and she was like, okay, no one's had that response yet. But she was sincere about it. It was really wonderful to be able to talk to her around that time about just how much her films have affected me.
This was originally released in 2007. It was Celine's first feature film, and she's had such a prolific career since. Frequently dips her toe back in the under 90-minute well after this 85-minute-long debut.
It's really interesting thinking about that trajectory, because her career and Mia Hansen-Love's careers are very sort of aligned. And Mia Hansen-Love was sort of one of the first French female filmmakers that I absolutely just completely fell in love with. I think I first saw Goodbye First Love quite a few years ago, and I'd been wanting to find her first film, All Is Forgiven, Tout Est Pardonné, which was also released in Cannes in 2007, and Water Lilies and All Is Forgiven shared the Louis Delluc Prize for Best First Film. So I see the two of them sort of existing together in my consciousness. Another film which I was able to see through my university's library. So I like seeing how their films have sort of moved in very similar directions, but also very different ones. Always sort of both sticking around that 90-minute runtime. Their films don't tend to sort of go off too far from that. But in my mind, as a bisexual woman, Mia Hansen-Love is the straight side of me and Celine Sciamma is the gay side of me. And they both sort of cater to those aspects of my life. They're wonderful. They are my favourites. I voted for both of them in the Sight and Sound poll.
You feel so fondly about both filmmakers' work, and that they both came up at the same time. Like 2007, a magic year for cinema.
Magical year for me. I don't know what I was doing in 2007. I would have been, 9 years old? So I don't think that I certainly wasn't seeing them in 2007, coming to them later on, but what a year.
The nice thing about sort of stumbling across a director, you know, later in life when they have a catalogue of work, is that you don't have to wait, you know, 2 or 3 years for that next film. You can do the deep dive. Did you, after Water Lilies, did you go through and see every other Celine Sciamma film that was available to you? Did this sort of start your relationship with her work?
Yeah, I'm trying to think if this might have been the last one I saw, actually. I mean, Petit Maman hadn't come out at that point, but I remember watching Girlhood and Tomboy around that time. It was Portrait was the first Celine film that I saw, and then the other two I saw around that time. And Tomboy is a really fascinating film. I think that the conversation around Tomboy is really interesting in terms of what the central character's relationship with gender is. I think that the film is really about just sort of gender nonconformity in children, which is interesting, rather than it necessarily being a sort of trans film, which it's often labeled as. And in many ways it goes well with Water Lilies. I think if you like one, you'll enjoy the other. They both are sort of exploring the messiness of childhood and adolescence and the relationship with gender and sexuality that particularly young women in Sciamma's focus have around that age. I mean, these are controversial films. I think it's important, and it is quite strange sort of watching Water Lilies, and this film absolutely could not have been made by a heterosexual male director. It would have just been absolutely impossible. And even Celine Sciamma sort of had to conceal from the people financing the film what was actually going to happen in terms of the sort of the sexual aspects of the film, especially the scene in which Adèle Haenel's character Florian asks her friend Marie, played by Pauline Lacroix, to deflower her, I suppose is the word that's often used around that scene. It's a really extraordinary moment, and one that I think's very, very powerful within the film.
Tu veux dire du côté des filles qui mangent des bananes? C'est ce qu'on raconte, c'est tout. Que tu l'as déjà fait. Et avec plein de mecs.
Ouais, c'est vrai. J'adore ça.
I think Celine Sciamma can really, you know, tackle, and I don't know necessarily like taboo subjects, but that subjects of everyday life which aren't really portrayed on screen, you know, through cinema. very often, and I really admire her for that. You know, the characters in Water Lilies are all, I think they're all 15 years old, you know, and they're very much, it is a coming of age story for the three protagonists in very different ways. But I do think only Celine could really bring this story to life in this way. And it still feel quite true, I think. It feels authentic. And it also never feels like the performers are being exploited as an audience member. Like, it feels, you know, like we're in a safe space with them and everything feels quite intimate. And that's just like Celine's fingerprints, I feel, as a fan of her work.
Yeah, I think so. And she appears in the film. She appears in a little cameo as an attendant at McDonald's, which is quite nice. It's nice to see her at the sort of start of her directorial career. It is interesting that she and Adele Arnell's sort of relationship started while they were making the film. Adele was actually sort of a bit older than Pauline when they were making the film. She was, I think, 18 when she made this film. And then they had a relationship for a number of years. And then made Portrait of a Lady on Fire together. It's quite an... I don't know how to describe it as other, just seeming like a very sort of messy lesbian French relationship, really. It's quite extraordinary. But certainly one that sort of is very beautiful between the two of them. I think that they're sort of very close. And I think that that level of closeness is really important to being able to make this film in the way that it is made and the levels of sensitivity that are required when making a film effectively about children. But of course, at an age when these kinds of feelings do exist and are sort of burgeoning within these young women. And it's heartbreaking. I mean, to have certain sort of gay and queer sensibilities at this age, it's really difficult to know how to articulate them and how to express them, particularly to sort of the object of your affections. And I think that Pauline Acqua, whose career is not the same as Adele Arnell. I mean, Adele Arnell has a sort of announced that she's not going to be making films anymore, but she's made quite a number of films since making Water Lilies, whereas Pauline Acqua hasn't done quite anywhere near as many films after this. But her performance in this film is just really subtle and very extraordinary. And to me, when we talk about sort of the female gaze and how the female gaze manifests itself in Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which is really important because that film is very much about gazing, the artistic vision, and how sort of the female artist, changing the artist to a woman. And, you know, that's discussed a lot within the film and the screenplay itself. Whereas in this film, it's done in really very subtle ways. I think my favorite moment in the entire film is when Marie and Florian get on the metro and Florian takes her top off and changes it. And then there's a cut and we are immediately sort of without any signaling to it, we are looking at from Marie's perspective at Florian, and she Adele Arnell just looks absolutely gorgeous within that shot. And we very much see her from the height level of the smaller Marie character. That's just, it's in that moment that you really understand how she's feeling and what's sort of developing within her, that again comes out of this sort of synchronized swimming narrative, which is also really interesting. I'm sure we can. How do you feel about sort of the swimming aspect of it? Because I suppose what I couldn't help watching this think about the sort of controversies around the film Cuties, which came out a few years ago, and sort of showing children and sort of performing in obviously synchronized swimming is not fully sexualized, but it is a form of performance from children. Had you seen the film before this time?
This was the last Celine Sciamma film I saw because it's so hard to get hold of in the UK. But the BFI, but I do remember seeing this film because it was one of my last cinema trips before the first lockdown in the UK in March 2020, when the pandemic was a thing. The BFI were doing, I believe, a Celine Sciamma season, or were doing some sort of season which required screening a print of Water Lilies, a 35mm print. And I really loved it. I was kind of blown away. It had lots of the similar themes and visuals and you know, that level of performance that you get in Celine Sciamma's later films, and you can see it's all here. And then I watched it a couple of times on DVD since then. But I do think that setting of the film, a lot of the film is about looking, and each character, it's about their personal desires, and you know, you're sort of you're with them. You know, and conveniently, I guess, in the film, a lot of the desires cross over with each other, and that's that messiness of being an adolescent. But that idea that synchronized swimming and the work in the water is the setting for this is a really great scenic, you know, designed by Celine Sciamma. The fact that one of the characters, Florian, is a, you know, the top synchronized swimmer, her when she's performing, she is performing for the audience, but the way Marie's looking at her is very different. But it means Marie gets a chance to look at her and to watch her and to engage with her, and I think it's sort of, it's a good way to symbolize their sort of level of intimacy as Pauline and as Marie and Florian start to talk to each other, when Florian invites her into the changing room, into the pool, come and watch. No, watch in the pool at our level. You know, like it's that sort of, like, there's nothing really to hide from, nothing to hide behind. Water is clear. And she can see, you know, she's got getting closer and closer to this person that she wants to get to know better. And there's some really striking shots of the camera goes down to Marie's eye line, whether it be in the pool or even underwater. And yeah, I think it's just a really good sort of like staging design. If you wanted that character to be a performer, I think synchronized swimming is like the most exposed version of performance, you know, you can do. I felt like, because it doesn't feel like she's exploiting the actors, I kind of felt okay watching it. I think sometimes I feel uncomfortable if I don't know, like something just, you know, alarm bells go off in your head. Like, was this okay? How was this filmed? And I guess part of that comes from a later knowledge of Celine Sciamma, after hearing her talk, you know, so passionately about the subject of trust and her own relationships within the film industry and her stance on certain things. It sort of reassured me, I suppose, or it was in the back of my head, so I didn't have to think about it as much. That, you know, I feel like Celine Sciamma is someone you could trust with younger performers and you know, just in general. I don't think she's out there to exploit people.
It's true. It's not something I really thought about the first time I watched it. It was just this time I was watching it, and sort of particularly around sort of conversations around exploitation and so forth. As I say, with films like Cuties coming out, but I was just thinking about it and like what distinguishes this film. I suppose the act of synchronized swimming in cinema is a really interesting one. It's not exactly something that sort of has a long, long history, but you can go back to like the by a waterfall sequence in Footlight Parade with Busby Berkeley, where you have sort of all of these identical, gorgeous white women all dancing together in a pool to, of course, Esther Williams and that kind of like blonde bombshell rising out of the water, and the sort of that level of full exposure is really interesting. That in the water you can see the full body and the way it moves. I think my favorite synchronized swimming might be Miss Piggy's big number in The Great Muppet Caper, which is extraordinary. but yeah, I think that it's interesting, but it is this sort of the cinematic legacy of synchronized swimming is one that is typically perceived from a male gaze perspective, whereas it is subverted here, but it's also consciously subverted. So there's this wonderful scene of dialogue where Marie thinks that Florian is sort of quite promiscuous. She's sort of seen by her friends in a sort of slutty way, and she says, "No, that's not actually how the situation is." She takes her aside to talk to her about it, and she tells her this story about this guy who's this sort of instructor who likes to give her massages before she goes and performs, and that he sort of had his erect penis visible to her in the water. And she says that it's kind of flattering. And the fact that that would be flattering is nauseating to hear, as a form of sort of sexual harassment that she's experiencing. But as you also said, that sort of her inviting Marie into the water has just a completely different dynamic, that there is this this sort of equity between women that does change that does remove sort of the, on a most basic sort of Freudian, Lacanian level about sort of the phallic nature of the gaze, that is sort of literally within those moments translated. But it's done it's not obvious. It's not done in a very sort of overt way, which is really important. Is, yes, of course, synchronized swimming is a metaphor for sort of the difficulty of adolescence and conformity and trying to keep afloat, while also being afraid to sort of break ranks. And for Florian, that is, you know, not leaning into the queerness of her sexuality. Whether or not that's really there is questionable, I suppose. But she very much sort of feels like she has to be seen by boys in a certain way if she's going to fit in and be part of the social circle, which ultimately is what sort of causes Marie a lot of difficulty.
Bon, je retourne. Mais pas mal, non? S'il est relou, je te fais signe, tu vas me sauver.
There's also another character in the film, Anne, played by Louise Plascher. What do you sort of make of her sort of fitting into the dynamic? Because it's really a film about three girls, and we've talked about the main two, but there's the third character as well.
Well, there's Anne, who I guess starts off as Marie's best friend, is sort of the vibe I'm getting. And the film is, you know, the characters are 15 in the film, and that is the age where you still have some childish elements, absolutely, but you are, you know, there's adult elements coming in, you know, you're growing up and things are changing. And I feel like Anne is the typical best friend from childhood, and her scenes with Marie are maybe a little bit more innocent in some ways, or a bit more childlike, being a bit more irresponsible, staying up late. You know, like going to the mall, that's where we do see Celine Sciamma's wonderful cameo as the McDonald's attendant. Also, just on that note, actually, because I saw this film much later, after I, you know, was aware of Celine Sciamma and her work and also knew what she looked like, when she came up on screen in NFT2 at the BFI, I leapt out of my chair. Like, oh my God! Celine Sciamma is not like an Alfred Hitchcock type who appears as a cameo in every one of her films. Absolutely. I think this might be the only time she appears on camera. So I was really like, whoa! So that was just a personal bit of enjoyment. But also, it's not, you know, she actually has a dialogue scene. She's not serving Anne the children's meal at McDonald's, and Anne says she wants the toy. And again, like, that's just so great about that. What's so great about that character? Like, she's very sort of upfront and to the point about what she wants, whether it be the toy or she sort of has a longing for Francois, who's the sort of unknowing affection of her desires for a lot of the film, who's also in a relationship with Florian as well. So there's sort of this, it's not really a love triangle, but like a love square. Right. Is that a word?
Yeah, sure.
But I liked how Anne represented Marie's childhood, but then Anne has her own, you know, sort of arc in the story. I thought her performance was really, it was really wonderful. To play the third wheel, which I think is, you know, what Anne has to do, can be quite hard. And also she has her own, you know, some challenging scenes, some quite heavy scenes. But I do think that, like, her performance is wonderful. But I think Anne is essential to the script, to making this work. Like, Marie needs to be stuck in the middle for her character to work. And Anne is a great foil to Florian.
Yeah, because she's providing a certain friendship, one that Marie is perhaps quite tired with. I did enjoy the scene when they're at McDonald's and she sort of tells her, like, you're taking up too much of my time, and just sort of made me think of Banshees of Inisherin and just how adolescent that film's plot is. It's just really funny. It was basically word for word similar dialogue to what's used in by Brendan Gleeson, sort of telling Colin Farrell not to leave him alone. I don't have time for you anymore, which was very amusing. But yeah, I think that Anne intrigues me. I feel sorry for Anne. I think Anne has a lot of the messiness of adolescence in terms of her sort of relationship with how she looks and how she interacts with others. I mean, there's a certain sort of neurodivergent aspect to her character that I find really interesting and I'm quite sympathetic towards. And I think she represents like how the levels of conformity and sort of feeling like you need to do things even though you don't really want to is really particularly moving in relation to her character, because I don't think that she feels as able to sort of distance herself from conformity as perhaps Marie does. I think Marie is very much, she's very independent. She knows her own mind and she won't do things that she doesn't want to do. Whereas I think that Anne is perhaps a bit more sort of vulnerable to that than she is. And she relies on Marie to sort of help her in that situation, which I think is quite a beautiful friendship within the film. And as you say, that it's good to have that in addition to Marie's relationship with Florian, which is a very different form of friendship and one that's very much sort of based in attraction, which is in itself very interesting. I did I like the reference to Perdan as well. I like the sort of Jacques Demy reference when Anne steals a necklace by putting it down her throat, and she tells Marie about this film where she doesn't say a donkey, she says a horse sort of shits diamonds, which I just love the idea that like French children are just like watching Jacques Demy films. I wish that was more the case in this country. But also the alignment of sort of my love of Demy's films with Sciamma's films is an interesting trajectory, and I find that quite a sweet reference.
Each character goes on their own journey, but you feel really sympathetic for that character. I did at least, and when Marie, you know, doesn't want to be friends with Anne anymore, when she pushes her away, that really got to me. You know, like I really felt for Anne, and Anne doesn't work so well on her own. Whereas Marie is, you feel like she's more than capable. That's one of the most emotional bits of the film for me, when Marie, you know, decides she doesn't want to spend her time with Anne and is really moving more towards Florian. And that got me again when I was rewatching it, you know, to talk to you. I was like, oh yeah, that's the bit that really stung.
Yeah, it's a difficult scene to watch, and as we've been saying, it's very authentic, I feel, to what these kinds of friendships and relationships are like. And I think that's why it moved me so much when I was watching it, because it sort of taps into a very specific form of queer adolescent experience that I can't think of in any other film in quite the same way. There's no issue of sort of coming out as anything. There's no labels being put on any of these characters. You can't really define the sexualities of these characters because they probably can't define their own sexualities. There's a real fluidity to it. I mean, I suppose, but that's what's so special about this film, is how just real it is and honest about feelings which you don't really see in many other films. I can't think of other films which quite capture it in the same way as this one does. I think that's probably why it's one of my absolute favorites, but also one that I can't watch too many times because it's too emotionally taxing. But certainly one that I recommend frequently to people. I just wish that it was easier for them to see it. Maybe there need to be more screenings like the one that you went to of Waterloo, so people can see it.
That sort of thing fascinates me as well. Like, you know, how how certain films can be removed from canon or sort of be hidden because of availability, because of commercial reasons, because the rights have lapsed, or some situation has happened with the distributor. Maybe they've ceased trading, and then all of the films are lost. And it's that stuff is as a film fan can be quite frustrating, but it sort of adds to the legend behind Water Lilies,
right? Like, yeah.
This prolific and very well known, even not many French language filmmakers or names, I suppose, in the UK, but with a certain audience. Céline Sciamma is a rock star. Like, for Petit Maman, I hosted a Q&A with her at the Finsbury Park Picture House, and it sold out so quickly, and all of the audience were like, they were there for Céline Sciamma, and that's incredible. So, like, a big name in world cinema in the UK, yet very hard to find this first film with a big name actor at the heart of it now, someone who's grown in profile in Adèle Haenel as well.
Yeah, definitely.
But listeners, if you do want to watch Water Lilies, I can recommend going to Computer Exchange, CEX, and it's about £25 for the DVD.
That is extraordinary.
Also, if you have one of these DVDs at home, keep hold of it, because it will probably just keep going up in value.
Goodness. Yeah, it will. I mean, it's on Criterion Channel, which we don't have in the UK. I don't know if there's a plan for a Criterion release. That would be nice. If they've got the rights to it, then for goodness sake, put it on a disc so people can sell it over here.
Don't sit on this wonderful film. And I guess because of all of those reasons, that's why it's not available for cinemas to particularly book. So the BFI, when you go to the BFI, they give you production notes and a little handout before you see the film. And they did have to say they were loaned this print by the French Film Archive, right, or something. So it was shipped over from Paris for this special screening and shipped back again. So there isn't even a print in the country.
That is horrifying. I find that very difficult to get my head around, as for all the reasons you've been talking about. It's sort of the perfect kind of film for people to watch in terms of runtime, in terms of themes which, as I've said, aren't really there in a lot of cinema. So I think that this is the sort of film that should one day I have young daughters, I will be showing them. So, it's the kind of film that you need, that sort of reaches its hand out and says, yes, this is normal. This is a valid experience. This is how a lot of young girls feel, and a lot of young girls go through, and that's fine and normal. And I think there's a real emotional beauty to that.
If, in the future we could do a real under 90 minutes or less film festival, if we could show this film on the big screen, where would you like to curate this film? If you could pick a venue and show this film to an audience.
Should be in a swimming pool. I don't know how often that's done. Maybe you could have is it in Cinema Paradiso where they have like a screen and people sit in boats and watch a film? I can't remember. Maybe I'm making that up. I'm trying to remember if that. I have a memory of people in boats watching a film. I think it's in Cinema Paradiso. That would be nice. In water. This film should be watched in water. I don't think there are many film venues where you could do that. Honestly, anywhere. Anyone with a nice, would be nice. Just screen it in every cinema. I mean, I have particular fondness for places like the Ultimate Picture Palace in Oxford. That's one of my favourite cinemas. Or maybe quite a small, intimate cinema like the Lexi Cinema would be a really nice place to show this film, with just like a small number of people. I live closest to the Ritzy in Brixton at the moment, so sort of putting it in their main screen would be gorgeous. I love it in there. It's such a wonderful room to watch films in, to see a very intimate film in that in quite a big environment, I think would be really interesting. I think this would make for a wonderful relaxed screening film. I absolutely will push to host one of those if we can get the film at some point, because I think that it's the kind of film that there's nothing particularly sort of distressing about this film. I don't think it's a very intense film, and I think that it would work really well. Yeah, are there any cinemas that are sort of in old swimming buildings or in a sort of derelict swimming pool. I can't think of any.
We could set up a pop-up screen. That's yeah. something we could do. You know, we could convert a cinema or swimming pool, into a cinema. I think close to both of us, the Brockwell Lido in Brockwell Park, an open-air swimming pool, has done screenings in the Lido. Warner Brothers hired it for a special preview of The Meg a few years ago. So you could watch The Meg poolside. So maybe that's the compromise, you know, it's like a Lido situation.
That would work. I just think having like the sound of water nearby would be really lovely to watch this film too.
That would be, I'd be up for that. Okay, so maybe that's what we do. We'll find sort of like a nice old Lido and sort of convert into a cinema for one night only.
Sounds amazing.
If you could curate a menu to go along with the film, you know, like a, you know, cinema snack sort of stuff, what would you serve alongside water lilies?
I mean, you need to have bananas. There's quite an important scene about sort of the allure of the banana, and the banana is sort of a phallic object in cinema, particularly of Adrian Lyne's Lolita adaptation from 1997, which has an extraordinary scene with a banana. So yeah, bananas are good. I don't know. You need some sort of like, what do teenagers like? Sort of something very disgusting looking and fluorescent, like a sort of slushy. Maybe that's the right thing to serve with this, like the sort of thing that you'd get at like a swimming pool from like a slushy machine, and maybe some like vending machine snacks, that kind of thing. I think
I was just thinking when you said swimming pool, it's vending machines, isn't it? So maybe the menu is provided via vending machine.
I think that's a great idea,
and teenagers love vending machines.
Exactly, obsessed with them.
Okay, dinner courtesy of vending machine.
Yeah. Just don't knock on the glass to get them out, because you'll get told off.
No, and definitely don't put your hand up in there, because you'll just get stuck.
Yeah,
we've all been there.
Bad idea. Bad
you can't explain that away.
Terrible idea.
You were trying to steal a Mars bar, weren't you? Yes, I was. Sorry.
The intense sensory memory that's just brought up. I can smell chlorine.
Yeah, I think watching this film in the vicinity of chlorine and those sort of, you know, yeah, swimming pool vibes would sort of add a 4D element to it.
Yeah, I think so.
And if you could invite a special guest to maybe introduce the film or to talk about the film afterwards, who would you like to extend an invite to?
Pauline Aqua. What's her take on this film? I want to talk to her. I feel like, say, Lynn Sciamma and Dodo Arnell have said a lot. I think that it would be really great to have, because this is her film. This is Marie's film. It's a film about Marie, and I think that she'd be the best person to talk about it. And I'd love to hear how she feels about it, wherever she is and what she's doing, and looking back on it, I think would be an extraordinary introduction.
Yeah, I think that'd be great. Okay, well, we can do that. So we'll invite Pauline Aqua for a dinner from a vending machine, and then watch the film in an open air Lido. It'd be a lovely thing to do.
Sounds wonderful. I can't wait.
Thank you so much for talking to us today, Lily. And it was really nice to talk about Celine Sciamma and sort of the wider Sciammaverse, as well as focusing in on Water Lilies, which is such a special film. I know we've talked about it sort of being hard to get hold of in the UK at the time of recording, but always look up whenever you're listening to this podcast, look it up, because it might suddenly become available. You know, the day after we release this podcast, it might be, you know, front and center on Netflix or something. So do look it up.
Well, Portrait of a Lady on Fire is on Netflix, so it could happen.
Could happen. Hey, it could happen. So hopefully it will be more readily available. But if not, 90 Minutes or Less Towers have got a DVD, which you know, get in touch. I'm sure we can pass this around. No problem there at all. But yeah, it was really great to talk, Lillian, and thank you so much for your time today. Where should people go if they want to stay up to date with your work?
Well, I'm on Twitter at Lil Crawf, which is LILLCRAWF, which is also my website, where I put all of my work. As I mentioned earlier, Listen to Lillian podcast and Autism Free Cinema podcast are available on all podcast streaming services. And yeah, I float around. I'll be in various different publications, sometimes appearing at the BFI. So yeah, anywhere and everywhere, anywhere that will have me. That is how it works as a freelancer. But thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to do this recording and to talk about one of my favorite films. So thank you for indulging me in my sapphic tendencies. Thank you.
Thank
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on your podcatcher of choice so you'll never miss an episode. You can also leave a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And if you have a moment, why not share an episode with your friends? Every recommendation helps. You can contact us on our website, 90minfilmfest.com. And you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at 90minfilmfest. The podcast is produced by me, Sam Clements, and Louise Owen. It's edited by Louise Owen, with sound mixing and additional editing by Luke Smith. Our music is by Martin Ostwick, and our artwork is by Sam Gilby. Enjoy those shorter films, folks. We'll be back in a couple of weeks.
We're a proud member of the Stripped Media Network.